Chapter 21. The first major river crossing was no big deal. We stopped at the riverbank to check out the best spot to get the RV down into the river. More importantly, the best spot for it to climb out on the far shore. The amount of dirt we had to move to create a ramp down into the water was a lot less than I'd feared. We had the job done in less than 2 hours. Next, I had one person drive the RV across and then back by herself. The driver for that shift was a Chinese named Liu, one of only 3 female Spec Ops soldiers with us. She drove the RV into the water. It slipped in the mud and made a big splash, wobbled a bit, then steadied and motored easily across. Liu reported the spot we'd chosen to climb out on the far bank was crumbly. I told her to use her judgment, and she selected a place upstream. The RV's treads powered it out of the water, and we could see Liu pumping her fist triumphantly in the front window. She came back across, loaded us aboard, and we went boating again. During the day, while we sat in or on top of the RV, there wasn't much to do except for the driver and the person acting as navigator. Smythe had everyone bring up maps of the scavenger base on their tablets, and together the Spec Ops teams created and rehearsed assault plans for a wide variety of contingencies. Most of our plans to hit the base depended on speed, surprise, and the cover and confusion of darkness. If we had to, we could attack during the day. That was not optimal. Thanks to the Kristang troop ship in Earth orbit, we had excellent night vision equipment. Our night vision gear looked like regular goggles, the kind you would use for skiing or riding a dirt bike or around power tools. Ordinarily, the goggles were clear and they worked like any plastic safety goggles on Earth, except these could stop a rifle bullet, and they repelled water, dust, and dirt using magnets or force fields or some super high-tech thing like that. Press a button on the left side of the goggles, and the inside of the lenses displayed whatever image you commanded from your Z-phone. You could select a night vision mode that displayed an enhanced view from the tiny cameras at each corner of the goggles, or you could pull up a map, data, or the view from someone else's goggles. That feature was very helpful to leaders. They could see what their troops were seeing in real time. You could even split the view, one side displaying a night vision image of what was in front of you, overlaid with a map, the other side displaying what some other soldier was seeing. It took some getting used to, and of course we had to stop treating it as a toy and learn how best to use different features depending on the situation. Until we gained more experience and proficiency, the simple night vision feature was best for most soldiers. Unlike the U.S. Army night vision gear I was used to, which restricted your peripheral vision and displayed a fuzzy, false color image, the Kristang goggles showed you a view similar to twilight. The colors were muted. Otherwise, it simply appeared less bright than usual. Doing imaginary dry runs on a tablet screen had only limited usefulness. Each night after we stopped and set up camp, Smythe created a small-scale model of the scavenger camp, using backpacks for buildings and rope for fencing. Smythe spent an hour every evening, rain or shine, but mostly rain, explaining assault plans under various scenarios. Using a small 3D model with everyone standing around it did help. Still, Smythe regretted that we didn't have the time to build a full-size model of the scavenger camp so the team could practice for real instead of imagining. Creating a fake scavenger camp hadn't been possible before we shot down their 2 aircraft. We couldn't risk the Kristang seeing a fake camp from the air. And before we set out in the RV, we hadn't known how fast we could travel. Now, Smythe thought we should have taken a couple of days, even a week, to practice assaults before we set out in the RV. 2 days after crossing the first river, we were driving through a series of hills that stretched across our path. When planning the trip, these hills were a major concern. They turned out to be not a problem at all. The RV's treads automatically adjusted to the terrain, and we made good time. All the driver needed to do was watch out for huge boulders that were strewn all over the area. The science team, back at base and watching our progress through satellite images, thought that these boulders had been left there by a glacier. A glacier that had covered the entire area, perhaps a kilometer thick, after Newark had been pushed out of its original orbit. As Newark's orbit changed and the planet warmed up again, the retreating glacier had dumped rocks it picked up on its journey to the south. The hills we drove over, a series of parallel ridges, were a terminal moraine, according to our science team. Basically, each ridge was where a glacier had stopped and dumped all dirt, rocks, and other junk it had accumulated while it was expanding. We came over a hill. The next hill was a kilometer ahead of us, with a nice, flat area in between. It was late afternoon, I was looking at the map, trying to find a good place to stop for the night. While the sun had been popping in and out of clouds all day, we would be getting a steady rain overnight into the next afternoon. I looked up from the map to gaze out the windshield, and the flat, open valley in front of us caught my eye. I grunted. On my iPad, I zoomed in the satellite image. Other than some rocks sticking out the ground, this area between hills was pretty much flat and free of major obstacles. "Captain Smythe," I said, "this area in front of us, what do you think?" He clearly didn't know what I was referring to.
"This area reminds me a bit of the Yorkshire Dales, sir, if..."
"No, I mean, here, look at this." I showed him the satellite image of the valley, over which I had pulled up an outline of the scavenger base.
"Interesting," Smythe said, glancing from my iPad screen to the actual terrain in front of us. "We are ahead of schedule," he pointedly added.
"That's what I'm thinking," I agreed. "We can call a halt here, set up a full-size replica of the scavenger base while we have light, and practice the assault tonight. It's going to rain tonight," I added.
"Excellent," Smythe grinned approvingly, "because it will most likely be raining during the actual assault."
Within an hour after the RV stopped, we not only had camp set up, we also had the fake scavenger base buildings and fences outlined with stakes and rope. Skippy inspected the layout through satellite images and gave Smythe grudging approval that the outlines were pretty darned accurate, within a couple inches in most cases. The rain that night ranged from steady to short downpours to a chilly, foggy mist, and it made an intense and exhausting night completely miserable for everyone. Other than me and the two civilian doctors, everyone thoroughly enjoyed themselves. I'd never seen dead tired people looking so happy when we halted the exercises just after the sun rose. Smythe had his team run one scenario after another, again and again and again and again, until each assault plan was executed as flawlessly as possible. The people having the most fun were the Alpha teams in Cristang armored suits. They were able to practice jumping from the ground to the top of the RV and back down, and racing at full speed, leaping over rocks and generally showing off. I observed the exercises. I did not participate. I'm not a Special Forces soldier. I hadn't gone through combat training with them. I didn't know their tactics. I didn't know them as well as they knew each other. If I had insisted on participating in the assault, I would only get in the way, and maybe get someone killed. Observing was enough. The Alpha teams were, of course, awe-inspiring. Although after watching them sprint 70 miles an hour and leap 30 feet high, it became somewhat less impressive, because I expected awesomeness from such advanced alien technology. What truly impressed me were the Spec Ops soldiers without fancy armored suits. Fast, silent, well-coordinated, they converged on their assigned targets from multiple directions. Because Skippy knew the interior layouts of buildings at the scavenger base, we were able to use rope to outline hallways, doors, and walls so the teams could practice breaching doors and clearing a building room by room. Making things simple for the team was the fact that we were not trying to capture prisoners. We didn't need to be concerned about damaging anything, except for the two items we needed to secure, the AI and the comm node. In other buildings, we could sweep rooms with rifle fire or use grenades. Wherever the AI and comm node were stored, we needed to be careful. We could not risk hitting either of the Elder artifacts with bullets or explosives. Skippy reported that there were a few Elder artifacts stored in the building where the scavenger leaders lived, items the scavengers thought were the most valuable. To us, those items were useless junk, and Skippy didn't care if we blew them up. The AI and the comm node were inside a secure building the scavengers used as an armory. It was behind an electric fence with heavy double doors that only the leaders had access to. If the AI and comm node were inside the armory when we launched the assault, our task was easy. Secure the armory building, eliminate the Cristang, then we could retrieve the precious items later. If, for some reason, the two items had been removed from the armory, or even were separated, then the assault team's task was exponentially more difficult. And whatever we did, we couldn't let the scavengers learn that the purpose of our attack was to steal two Elder artifacts, or they could threaten to destroy them and stall our attack. Smythe had plans for multiple assault scenarios. That was all great, and the team practiced multiple options until they executed each plan like clockwork. What Smythe could not plan for was the unknowns.
Technically, we did have plans for the unknowns we could anticipate. The weather, where in the base the scavengers would be sleeping, how many leaders and laborers were awake, what weapons the leaders had with them. Skippy reported that the scavengers did not have any set schedule for base security. Some nights, two or more leaders remained on watch throughout the night. Most nights, the leaders snoozed peacefully all night, relying on their electronic monitoring systems to alert them to any trouble. In one way, the scavenger base was an easy target for a surprise attack. The scavengers had plenty of weapons, including four functioning powered armor suits. In addition to standard Kristang rifles, the armory held heavy weapons, grenades, anti-armor rockets, and zingers. What mattered to our planning was that except for the suits and rifles the leaders kept with them in their secure compound, all the weapons were locked up inside the armory building. On a planet with no native threats, the leaders were mostly concerned about being threatened by their own workforce. That made it easy for us. We needed to be concerned primarily with taking out the leaders. Most of Smythe's plans assumed the leaders would be inside their compound at night. During nights, the laborers were locked inside their own compound, unable to get out. The exterior doors of buildings in the laborers' compound were locked at night, and electric fences crisscrossed the base, protecting the leaders from the laborers and keeping the laborers away from the armory. Once we took out the leaders, we could deal with the laborers later. That was the plan. What we couldn't plan for was the unknowns we couldn't anticipate. For that, we needed flexibility and individual initiative. Fortunately, Spec Ops soldiers excelled at those qualities. I needed to trust that whatever happened, the team could handle it. Our two doctors had peacefully slept through the night in the RV with earplugs and white noise playing on the radio. When it got to be an hour before sunrise, I roused them, and the three of us got a hot breakfast ready for the troops. The breakfast was much appreciated. After we struck camp and removed all traces of the practice area, we resumed traveling toward the scavenger camp, with the two doctors taking turns driving and me navigating. After six mostly solid hours of sleep, the team was fully refreshed, and it was my turn to sleep. I put in earplugs, strapped myself into a seat with a baseball cap down across my face, and the lurching and bouncing of the RV quickly had me soundly asleep. Hopefully I didn't snore. "Stop here," I ordered a couple days later. Smythe got out of the RV with me. We walked forward to inspect the slope ahead of the RV. It was not an ideal situation. The whole area was crisscrossed by canyons, most with sides far too steep to attempt driving the RV up or down them. There was only one possible route we saw from the satellite data. It looked a lot more drivable from the satellite when we were planning the trip than now when we were there on the ground. The plan was for us to drive northwest along a relatively wide, shallow canyon until we came to a side canyon. That one was almost like a road that led gently up to the plateau where we wanted to be. The main canyon had a stream running through it. The stream occupied the center bottom of the canyon's shallow V-shape. So did a lot of rocks that had tumbled down over the years. It had looked from the satellite that we could drive partway up on the right side of the canyon wall, avoiding the big rocks at the bottom. The canyon was broad and shallow enough that the side walls sloped gently until they reached the lip of the plateau above us. "This could be a problem," I mused, looking at the terrain the RV needed to drive over. Avoiding rocks did not appear to be a problem. They were as widely spaced on the canyon wall as they'd appeared on the satellite images. The problem was that in places, the side slope of the canyon wall was steeper than we expected. A few sites were almost 45 degrees. Smythe and I walked forward with the Spec Ops team leaders and our most experienced drivers. We walked over a mile and a half from the RV.
"If we can keep to this line,"
Williams drew an imaginary line on a shallow diagonal across the slope,
"we should be all right. We'll get up there."
He pointed to a spot up the canyon wall higher than we wanted to go.
"Hang an easy left and drive back down."
"Except for those two ridges."
Smythe pointed back to where the side slope of the canyon wall was steep.
"If we had time and equipment, we could hack out a road. The first one is only 100 meters, maybe, but the second one must be half a kilometer. We don't have the time, equipment, or manpower."
He pulled out his Z-phone and looked at the satellite image of the area, comparing it to what we were seeing on the ground.
"This may not be as bad as it appears from here. Do you ski, Colonel?"
"Snowboard some." My family is more into snowmobiles. Our part of Maine is fairly flat, and it's a long drive to go snowboarding.
Smythe nodded.
You know how, when you're at the bottom of a mountain, looking up at the slope, it doesn't appear to be very steep, and you're confident you can get down it. Then you get off the lift at the top, and sometimes, suddenly, that same slope looks like it goes straight down. Maybe this is like a ski mountain. Maybe it looks more difficult from up here.
Skippy, I called. What do you think? Can you drive the RV past those obstacles, or will it flip over on its side?
What am I, an off-road racer? Skippy asked. Yes, it is possible for the RV to drive on a slide slope even steeper than those two areas. The treads have a limited self-leveling function, where the tread on the lower side will extend down to negate the slope. You can also shift cargo inside the RV so the weight is on the uphill side. However, I should not be driving. Even with the micro-wormhole facilitating communications, there is a time lag between me and the surface. I might not be able to react quickly enough. A human driver in the vehicle could feel the operation of the treads in real time and adjust accordingly. The problem is that the surface is soft and saturated with water. It could be somewhat unstable. I can't predict that. Someone is going to have to drive it for you, Joe. I suppose we're too far from Earth to call Uber. And it sure wasn't going to be me driving. I had not taken a shift at the RV's controls. We walked back to the RV, making a very careful examination of the two problem areas along the way. Then we got everyone out of the RV, shifted cargo around inside and tied that down securely, and then Lieutenant Zhang took the controls and proceeded slowly forward. Everyone with driving experience had offered to take the RV over the obstacles. I didn't want to pick a favorite or do something silly like draw straws, so since Zhang had driven us into the canyon, he could drive us out. There were some hairy moments when we all thought the RV was going to tip over and the treads slipped wildly in the mud. Zhang remained calm. The treads stopped slipping and bit into the soft soil, and the RV slowly inched back into relatively flatter ground. When the treads on both sides returned almost to normal configuration, we all cheered. Zhang endured many backslaps as we climbed back into the RV. He gave me a thumbs up.
Thank you for your faith in me, Colonel, he said.
Would you like a break? I asked, noticing that his hands shook slightly. He'd known that the success of the entire mission and the survival of humans on Newark had depended on him for a moment.
Yes, Colonel, he admitted. I've had enough driving for today, I think.
Good job, I said as I gave him a gentle pat on the back and extracted from my pocket a piece of chocolate I'd been saving. You deserve this. Zhang looked at that piece of chocolate, a precious enough item on Newark, but especially so on our current expedition, like I'd handed him a bar of gold. He accepted it in both hands, bowed slightly to me, and wrapped it carefully in a cloth before placing it in a pocket. The other Chinese soldier said something to him in Mandarin, and he broke into a grin. Apparently, I had just made his day. I was tempted to climb onto the roof and ride up there. The RV had a roof rack, and we'd rigged up a couple places to sit and an awning to keep rain off. As it was partly sunny that day, the awning had been taken down and stowed. The roof could be chilly. It was also a popular enough place to ride that I'd had to limit people to taking shifts up there. They changed when we changed drivers. Inside the RV was warm and dry, out of the wind. It was also dreary, as the RV had few windows. Realizing that if I went on the roof, someone would have to come down, I stayed in the RV, adjusting my seat so I could see out the front windows. One of our SEALs named Taylor took the wheel, as he had the next shift, and Lieutenant Williams stood behind the driver's seat.
Right up there, by that big round rock. That's the top, Williams pointed out. Make a straight line for it, and when we're over the crest, let it fall off to the left, and we'll get back down to our original course.
Got it,
Taylor replied. Adams went back to his seat, strapped in, and we headed off. All went well at first. Taylor carefully and confidently drove us up to the crest, let the RV naturally turn slightly to the left, and drove a fairly straight line toward a gap between two large rocks. Those two rocks, I remembered from the satellite images. We had planned our route to avoid them. Now that I saw them from the surface, they were not a big deal. The gap between them was 4 or 5 times wider than the RV, with some smaller stones half buried in the ground The RV's treads morphed shape to roll over the stones as if they weren't there. After shooting the gap, it was an easy drive back down to the original course we'd planned, parallel to the stream at the bottom of the canyon. Even at the careful rate that Taylor was driving, it would only take us a few minutes to get back down to the intended track, which at that part of the canyon was almost like a shelf notched into the shallow canyon wall. To my eyes, I wondered if the shelf had ever been a road, created millions of years ago by Newark's original inhabitants. That idea was stupid, I knew. No road could have lasted that long, especially not in a canyon carved by the advance and retreat of glaciers, glaciers massing millions of tons. The shelf, and the one on the opposite canyon wall, had been created by the stream in full flood, raging over its banks and carrying stones, smashing and scouring the soil of the canyon walls, each year digging the canyon deeper and wider, carrying its soil eventually grain by grain down to the sea. It would take us only a few minutes to get down to the shelf notched into the canyon wall, even though Taylor was being extra careful driving in the soft, muddy soil. And then, suddenly, it didn't take any time at all. "Whoa!" Taylor shouted a warning from the driver's seat at the same time we all felt the RV rock side to side, then drop sickeningly. "What's wrong?" I shouted back, pushing myself up in the seat to see through the window in the front of Taylor. Taylor replied much more calmly than I could have managed. "I didn't do anything. The treads won't..." "Ah!" As he gave the alarm, there was a high-pitched whine from the treads on the right side. The RV lurched to the left and dropped again, and then it rolled. The RV rolled to its left, rocked back to the right, then to the left again, and kept going. Out the driver's window, I saw someone jump off the roof. The RV was rolling over, and the people on the roof weren't waiting for an engraved invitation to get the hell off the thing. It was chaos. Sheer chaos. The RV rolled over and over, onto its left side, then the roof, then the right side, paused ever so briefly to rock on the protesting treads, and rolled again. I lost track of how many times it rolled. After counting two complete flips, my head was bouncing around too much to be aware of minor details. For some reason, the RV wasn't rolling fast. It was almost a controlled motion, and it didn't seem to be gaining speed. It was chaos inside the RV. Let me tell you something about the Spec Ops people. They didn't panic. They all kept their cool, kept situational awareness the whole time, looked for opportunities to do something useful to affect the outcome. Every one of them, I'm sure, knew how many times we rolled. It was chaos. We had no control. We were tumbling down a slope toward a rock-filled, icy, raging stream at the bottom of the canyon. And there was no shouting, no screaming, no panic. I felt almost ashamed of myself until I managed to follow their example. It was a damn good thing I had insisted that everyone be strapped into seats any time the RV was moving, or we would have suffered serious injuries from people being tossed around inside the RV. After I don't know how many puzzlingly ponderous slow rolls, the RV came to rest on its treads, rocked side to side two or three times, then stopped. "Is everyone all right?" I asked stupidly. "Anyone injured?" I asked more intelligently.
"I'm good."
"Okay here, sir." Everyone sounded off, and other than bruises and bumps, no one was hurt. "Get the door open. Let's get out of here before this thing rolls again," I ordered, and made sure I was the last person out the door. Because the door was on the left, downhill side, I ran the hell away from the RV in case it decided to roll on top of me. "Holy shit," I exclaimed. The RV had ended properly on its treads, right on the shelf where we wanted to be. Looking up the slope, I could see all four of the people who had been on the roof were on their feet waving to us, apparently uninjured. And I could see the source of the problem. The ground had given way beneath the RV up the slope. Soil had slipped in a mini landslide of mud and soft dirt. Once the RV rolled the first time, it got momentum started and kept going down the gentle slope of the canyon wall until it fell onto the shelf-like notch.
"Huh!"
Williams laughed, relieved now that he'd seen no one was seriously injured.
"Taylor, you didn't need to get us here so fast."
We all laughed. Laughed, and we couldn't stop. I laughed until I had tears in my eyes. Laughed in relief that I wasn't dead, that the RV wasn't upside down in the stream. The RV somehow was on its treads and not even the windows were broken. The door still even worked. It was sticky, sure,
I had expected the door to be solidly and possibly jammed into its frame after such a shock.
Skivvy, I inquired. How badly is the RV damaged?
It's fine, Joe. You took quite a tumble there. Are you okay?
It's fine? I asked, astonished.
Yep. The Kristang build these things tough. They're designed to be dropped by parachute. The reason it rolled over so slowly is the gyroscopes counteracted the roll a bit. They're designed to do that. You can back in and drive it away, no problem. You better fix the roof rack first. It automatically retracted when it sensed the roll, but I can see it's bent in some places. Nobody is hurt.
Minor bumps and bruises.
Damn, Skippy. I walked around the RV and looked at it in amazement. How is this thing not laying in pieces all over the place? How did the treads not get busted off?
The treads and pontoons would have retracted automatically as needed. The onboard computer knew when to extend the treads to stop the roll when it could.
Like I said, these things are built tough, Joe. Good thing, too, because the warranty on that RV expired a long time ago.
Tell you what, I can get you a sweet deal on rust-proof undercoating. I know a guy who knows a guy.
Thanks, Skippy, but we don't plan on owning this thing long enough for that to matter. I'll throw in a set of air fresheners. You got an RV stuffed full of monkeys. Air fresheners could come in mighty handy, Joe.
I laughed.
Skippy, if things go according to plan, in a few days, we're going to dump this RV in a lake or bury it so no one will ever find it. Rust-proofing and air fresheners would be counterproductive at that point.
Damn.
Joe, remind me never to let you borrow my car, if I ever have one. When the people who had been on the roof walked down to us after picking up things like the awning, jackets, and several backpacks that had been flung off the roof on the RV's way down, I got everyone to pose in front of the mud-smeared and only slightly dented RV. Setting my Z-phone on a rock, I asked Skippy to take photos of our group, which he did without any snarky comments. Maybe he was genuinely glad that we were alive, or maybe he was too busy repairing the Dutchman to play any pranks on us then. I appreciated it. When we were done with the photos to commemorate our miraculous survival, I told Taylor to get back in and check if Skippy was correct about the RV being drivable. Taylor gave me a quizzical look.
You sure you want me driving again, sir?
Taylor, I said, it wasn't your fault. Besides, what are the odds that will happen to you twice? Skippy chimed in.
Was that a question for me, Joe? Truly, I don't have enough data to calculate the odds. I'd need ground-penetrating radar to examine the soil.
That was a rhetorical question, Skippy. No number crunching needed.
Good, because without further data, my estimate of the odds would only be accurate within 65%.
Thank you, Skippy. We've got it from here. Taylor, do your thing.
The RV drove just fine. Taylor went forward 100 meters, then backed up to us. If the soil of the shelf was saturated with water and unstable, running the RV back and forth over it should have caused it to shift. Smythe and I walked the tracks the RV had made. There were no cracks in the soil, no signs of the ground shifting at all. Satisfied that we were as safe as we could be, we fixed the roof rack as best we could, loaded up the RV, and drove off again. This may not be a fun-filled family vacation, but it sure was turning out to be memorable. Smythe was looking at the photos I had forwarded to everyone's Z-phone.
Bishop, he slipped for a moment. Colonel,
he was smart enough not to call attention to his mistake.
In Afghanistan, I was in a helicopter that went down. We were high up in the mountains, and the trailing rotor blade stalled or some bloody thing like that. We only fell 50 meters onto snow. It could have been worse. The helo slid down the mountain and lodged against a rock before it would have fallen over a cliff. We had some broken bones. Nothing serious, he said in a nonchalant SAS manner. Before the rescue helo arrived, we posed for a photo in front of the busted bird. He pressed a few buttons on his Z-phone and pulled up that photo. That's me on the left. The photo didn't look any different from he did now. It must have been relatively recent.
When was the SAS in Afghanistan?
When was this? Oh, never mind, you shouldn't tell me, and I don't care. If I'd cared, the details were in his service record.
Ha! Smythe laughed.
As if that matters now, sir. We know the only bloody secret that matters now, about Skippy playing games with wormholes. What I was going to say, sir, is until today, that pick of the downed helo was my favorite. But now, a photo of us having survived rolling down a canyon in a stolen alien RV on a planet thousands of light years from Earth? That beats all, in my opinion.